You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello everyone, you may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Hey there. What follows is an audio version of an interview originally recorded as part of our Monster Talk Live streaming series that Karen and I hosted during 2020. As of this posting, we're not currently doing those live shows, but they are archived on YouTube. You can check the show notes for a link to this particular episode. And the live format's definitely something we're going to try to get back to in the future. These episodes do not get the normal editing treatment of a traditional Monster Talk, and because of the variety of issues that happen during live recordings, the audio quality may be wildly varied, and you should assume there will be some not-safe-for-work content, so I'm posting all of these as explicit just in case. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting Monster Talk. Your contributions at patreon.com/monstertalk and your positive reviews on the podcasting platforms and applications that you use to listen help us reach new listeners and spread the important message that monsters can be a great tool to learn critical thinking. We need critical thinking now more than ever. Monster Talk is hosted by me, Blake Smith, and my co-host, Dr. Karen Stolzno. If you enjoy this show, please check out our deep catalog of fascinating interviews with experts about psychology, sociology, anthropology, folklore, religion, and more.
Monster Talk.
Yeah, that was new. Yeah, it was totally different. Yeah.
Introduction to this kind of mini series that we've got, we're starting with Monster Talk.
Excellent. So I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner. We've got a guest tonight. Yeah. His name is Matthew Baxter. And we brought him on the show because we're doing a special series at the moment called Debased on a True Story.
Right. And we've got a lot of the entries for this. This is going to be a lot of fun, I think. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead. Sorry.
No worries. So, Matt, do you want to do a quick introduction?
Sure. My name is Matt Baxter. I've been a paranormal researcher for close to 30 years now. I have conducted many haunted tours in the Denver area and have given a lot of different talks on science and the paranormal over the years. And have been, you know, kind of a science educator in that sense. And one of the things that I've focused on over the years is these movies that like to say they're based on a true story.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And coming from this area, you've actually had a lot of experience with some of the lore. Even though this movie is set in Seattle, a lot of it's actually based on stuff that happened in the Denver area. So. Mm-hmm. The movie we're talking about tonight.
We're going to be talking about.
Yeah. Go ahead, Karen. Sorry.
We're going to be talking about the 1980 movie The Changeling. So not to be confused with Changeling, which was a 2008 movie about the Wineville chicken coop murders with Angelina Jolie. So not that one. We're talking about the 1980 movie. And
right, the creepy ghost story movie. Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
So this movie was released March 28th, 1980. I should mention, this is going to be a spoiler show. If you haven't seen The Changeling, we're going to ruin it for you. So just keep that in mind. So I think it's a fantastic movie, but it came out in 1980. What are you doing? You should have taken a look at it by now. So,
yeah, good point.
All right, this movie was directed by Peter Medak, and I'm going to give a little summary. Okay, so following the tragic death of his wife and daughter, composer John Russell abandons his successful career in the concert scene of New York City and heads to Seattle, Washington to start fresh away from all the reminders of that tragedy. And what could possibly lift him from his depression faster than moving into a long uninhabited mansion as the sole occupant? And before you can say boo, he's experiencing a series of unexplained noises and phenomena that would have any sensible person packed and moved. But despite his grief, Mr. Russell, played by the indomitable George C. Scott, is going to get to the bottom of this mystery. He's not, it turns out, a runaway from his problems kind of guy after all. So he's assisted in his investigation by Claire Norman, an agent from the Seattle Historic Society, who also seems more than a little interested in Mr. Russell. As a note, that is actually played by his real-life wife, Trish Vandeveer. Russell finds out that his house is haunted by the ghost of a child who was apparently living in an attic-level room at one point, but that room has been hidden behind a bookshelf. And in a very complicated plot twist around the classic trope of laying a ghost, the composer and historian team up to find out what happened to the little boy in the attic. And the title, The Changeling, hints at the nature of the haunting by referring to fairy lore about changelings, which we'll talk about. And this story has murder, intrigue, classic haunting tropes, tragedy, music, horseback riding, politics, intimidation, automatic riding, self-propelled ghost wheelchairs, apportations, telekinesis, and more. Plus, its cast includes the aforementioned team of George C. Scott and Trish Vandeveer, as well as the venerable Melvin Douglas and character actor John Colicos. It is a delight. I love this movie, and I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah, I loved it too. I really enjoyed it. So I saw it a long time ago and then watched it again recently. And it's just great. Every time you see it, you pick up more things that you didn't capture the last time.
Yes, it's very much in the tradition of like The Haunting. It's just a really a creepy film that increases in tension as it goes along and then has a very exciting, if challenging, conclusions.
What do you think of the film?
We've got Matt Baxter with us.
Yeah.
What's this got to do with Denver?
Well, first off here,
let me make you enabled. Oh, no, you're enabled. You can do it. You can do it.
So here's the cover, of the, I would say either DVD or the poster for The Changeling right here. It was a very, very fun movie. And again, you know, Blake had already said it, but we have to say it again. We're going to ruin the movie for you. So be prepared. Spoilers ahead. Now, going into this, we should probably talk about a couple of things. One being the fact that this is...
Ghost child there with you?
No, there's no one here. what we probably want to talk about is what a changeling is, in terms of, you know, fairies and things like that, the folklore. So I don't know if you wanted to say anything about that, Karen or Blake.
Well, yeah, I don't think this is a changeling. This story is about a changeling in the traditional sense. I don't think we've actually done an episode on changelings, have we, Blake? I think we've talked about them over the years.
Right. We haven't actually done a dedicated episode on changelings, but we have talked about them briefly. They fit into fairy lore. It's the idea that a fairy or fairies will come along and exchange your child or loved one with a substitute. And for years and years, I just thought this was peculiar fairy lore. Like, I just thought it was an odd bit of folklore. Mm-hmm. But a few years back, I went back and read some of the writings of Martin Luther about this topic and realized after reading that, that what he was really describing sounds very, very much like what happens if you're a parent of an autistic child. The child develops normally up to a certain point, and then suddenly there's changes that happen. And
they might not speak, or they
right.
stop smiling, or
exactly.
they might appear to be in their own world.
Exactly. And also, it's not just young people. Changeling lore also had bearing on older people, adults. So if someone had a stroke or started suffering dementia, those kind of changes in their personality and behavior could also be attributed to fairies. So in the one sense, it's an explanation. But in another darker sense, it was a way that people justified getting rid of these people who were different than us. So it's very scary and creepy in that sense, than a supernatural way.
We find bizarre ways to explain things we don't understand. And this was definitely a great example of that. So
I wouldn't say in the movie though that's a traditional kind of changeling.
Right. And the way it falls into the movie, and we'll get to that organically as we go through the plot. But it is an interesting and clever title in the sense that it does have and it involves a story about someone being swapped for someone else. So
absolutely. So yeah, I think we've got several things going on here. We've got the movie itself. Then we have the folklore that is behind the movie, and then we have the facts. So
exactly.
I think we want to treat those three different segments.
Well, I certainly want to talk about the movie a bit because this is a great movie. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether it's based on a true story or not, this is a fun movie. And so many movies these days, I think, really fall short when it comes to achieving that really good creepiness. This one, on the other hand, this one on the other hand really does a great job of keeping the creepiness going. When we look at things like the guy moves into this huge house for one, and it is a very freaky thing because it's one guy in this huge house, and that really can cause a lot of problems because of all the noises that a big house can make when you're by yourself.
Yes.
And so he's already starting to experience some of these things. And we have the trope of the red rubber ball, and which is such a great one. I mean, we've seen it in a lot of movies, but it seemed like the first really big movie that it happened in was...
Yes, the first wildly... I mean, like, this was an extremely successful film. And it really made this a trope worth copying. You want to go to a clip?
Well, I will add too that just over the years, with all of the investigations that I've done, a lot of places have had that trope. A lot of places, like Waverly Hills Sanatorium, had this same idea of, oh, there's this red rubber ball which just appears out of nowhere, and or it might even be used as a tool to try and lure ghosts out, to use it as a toy to attract ghost children and things like that. But it's really permeated ghost hunting lore over the years.
Well, it also fits into that the thing in horror movies where they subvert what should be fun and innocent imagery into creepy and scary. A child's musical toy box, a doll, mm-hmm. you know, even the little monkey with the symbols, all those things are not really scary. Maybe the monkey's scary, but in general, they're not scary. And then they become terrifying in the context of a horror scenario.
Absolutely. So. Yeah. Sorry, let's play that video.
This is the scene from The Changeling.
Yeah. It was such a great moment. Because that particular ball happened to have been his daughter's.
Exactly. Which he left. Well, he didn't leave it behind, did he? It was a piece of furniture, and then it just disappeared. So it was just confusing and scary.
I think he had it in a writing desk or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, spoiler wise, he ends up at one point throwing it off a bridge. So he's sure that it's gone. And then it shows up again all wet. It's fantastic.
Yeah. So it was a really interesting thing to have that ball show up like that. The thing is, you know, we start to wonder, we've seen this in a few other movies. What was kind of the first one? And I think the the Changeling was the biggest movie to come along to have this happen in it. And then it became a lot more popular. Now I have a little thing I grabbed off of YouTube of a bunch of different uses of the ball bouncing down the stairs. And we can kind of talk about that a little bit as it goes.
And enjoy the music that accompanies it.
I've got it muted.
Yeah. Oh,
just so.
It was folk music.
Yeah.
Well, it's
very mariachi, a kind of sort of friendly, or like a kid's TV show or something. I don't know. Yeah.
So it's not exactly, it doesn't exactly go with it, I think. But this gives us an opportunity.
At least we can talk over this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and then for some reason it jumped back. So that's perfect. Okay, here we go.
There we go.
So it starts off this movie, it pops out of her mouth, which I don't know why. But here's the Changeling. 1980. So remember, The Changeling 1980 was kind of the first big movie to have this in it. And now we're still here, 2015. Curse of Chucky, 2013. The Awakening, 2011. That was a great movie.
Wow. So many movies.
2009, 2005. Then we get into a lot of movies that I don't want to pronounce. 1966.
Looks like it's Italian or something. Or... Yeah.
1983.
No, I'm thinking about The Prisoner. But yeah.
Troll 2, 1990.
Wow.
Paranormal Activity 4, 2012. Another one I don't want to pronounce, 1973. The Skeptic. I haven't seen that one. The Conjuring.
Yep.
So as you can see, there's quite a few of these that have popped up over the years.
Yeah, it's become quite a horror trope. Yep. Yep. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
absolutely.
But then we've got what were some of the good creepy moments in this movie? I mean, one for me is you're hearing that rhythmic metallic thumping that would just start.
But you don't know if it's a chime or a pipe or what it is until it's finally explained. Yeah,
right.
It's especially creepy when he wakes up at 6 a.m. and he's crying because he's had a nightmare about his wife and his daughter dying, and then that starts immediately. It's really jarring. But I think one of my favorite bits is just, as Blake was saying, I love the progression of the film, and it just starts out so gently. It doesn't have jump scares and things like that. It's just really gradual in the way it exacerbates. But I love the way it starts with him playing the piano. One of the keys isn't playing and he ends up leaving the room, and then that key plays by itself when he leaves.
Yeah.
So I think that's...
It seemed like...
That's really fun.
It's not literally inspired by it, but it seemed like heavily influenced by the Robert Wise film The Haunting, which is based on the story The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. And a lot of the effects are the psychological... But the use of sound and just showing pictures of the house, scenes of the house, and making you dread further. And then sometimes making you dread, don't go behind there, don't go there, don't. And then he does, and he keeps doing these things. No, stop, please, no, stop.
Well, that's certainly a creepy scene when he goes up to the child's room.
Yes.
Let's talk about the whole lack of jump scares. And it was no need for it at all. When he does go upstairs and he's trying to get into that little room, you know, he knocks the lock off with the hammer, and then he's slamming his body against the door. He hits it twice, and he pulls back for the third time, and the door just gradually opens all by itself. And you could tell that it was not going to open before, as hard as he was hitting it. And that was just such an amazing moment to me. It was like, oh, that is creepy.
There were a few scenes like that where a door would just open just very gently, a creak open. And
absolutely.
Yeah,
it's interesting because in a sense the ghost here, again, it's a spoiler thing, but the ghost here is that of a child that was murdered. And the child seems to be simultaneously have amazing powers, but yet to be constrained in its ability to directly communicate. It can't just come out and say, here's what's going on, please go fix this. It's got to, it seems like it's limited in some way. It's very interesting.
It almost seems like it was waiting for him to come into the house, because what's that quote? I guess we'll be coming up to that shortly. The lady from the Historical Society. I don't know how far along that is in the
just a few slides away, because the next big thing was the seance. That was one of the best, I think, representations of a great seance. Now, because
it was really well done.
Yeah, when he goes up to that room and he finds the wheelchair and the music box and you know, things like that, the metal tub.
Music box and the fact that that plays a tune that he thought he had just composed.
Yes, that was really neat. Yeah, yeah. He's a musician. Beautiful. It was like the song itself was haunting him. He thought he'd made it up, and it was actually an older song. Yeah, it's very cool, because it seems like what had happened is people had come and this is all subtext. I mean, it's not really explicitly stated, but people had come and stayed at the place and were being scared away by the hauntings. Mm-hmm. But the Historical Society didn't want people to know that, so they were sort of suppressing it. He comes along, and he's been opened up raw because of the death of his wife and child. So maybe in a sense, even though he's not psychic per se, he seems to be more open and susceptible to the communication from the ghost. Mm-hmm. And he wants to help. He's really kind of a musician and a troubleshooter. So
yeah, I think he has an affinity with the child, and certainly going through all of his personal objects upstairs, the journal and seeing the wheelchair and his toys. I think he really seems to have some kind of link to the ghost.
And they do in every horror movie where they do this, it's my favorite part, the research phase where they go to the library, and this is before the internet. So they go back and they hit the microfilm and microfiche. Ah, so good. I love it. I love the library trip. So we get our backstory.
We thought that was really interesting too, because shortly we'll start to get into the folklore and the facts behind the movie.
The difference.
We just realized that in the movie, he goes back and he tries to do some research into the history of the house. And yet in the folklore and the true story, the fellow goes straight to psychics, goes straight to the paranormal. He doesn't go to the library and do research. He just immediately turns to talking to psychics.
Right, exactly.
And calls so the movie's more skeptical in some ways.
It is. Yeah.
But that's what makes a good movie. If you've got a good skeptic that poo-poos everything, and by the end they're converted to a believer, that's a good horror movie right there.
Mm-hmm. But if you look at the plot, I mean, the plot is, here we go. The plot is a child was murdered because the child was not necessarily healthy and stood to inherit a bunch of money. So the parent was being left out of the will. So the will skipped a generation. But until the child reached maturity, the parent would have been in charge of the fortune. And so the parent decides the solution here is get rid of the sick child, replace it with a healthy child.
A changeling,
exactly. And then the healthy child grows up to be a senator and is super wealthy. And so the plan worked, except for this pesky ghost going around trying to get things settled and point out that he's actually been a victim. So
at the last minute.
Really. So the thing is, the shocking thing is, you watch this amazing movie, this convoluted plot, really cool horror. I love the pace. I love everything about this movie. Mm-hmm. Yet you find out it's allegedly based on a true story. And you have to wonder, how could this possibly be based on a true story? This is a ridiculous story. Yet it is. So explain.
It's loosely based on some folklore.
Well, allegedly based on a true story, right?
Yeah. Let's hit just a few more things here. Let's talk about the fact that I think this is one of the first movies that really showed automatic writing, for example. And which was a great thing to watch, because not only were you watching this woman scribble and write these things out, but you're hearing this man sort of announce what she's writing as she's doing it. And it created this really dramatic.
It's simultaneously dramatic and as close to cool spiritualism sort of stuff as I've ever seen portrayed.
Oh, yeah. The psychic is in that trance and she's just kind of staring into the distance and communicating with the spirit. And it's very scary.
And it could have been campy. It could have been terrible, but it isn't. It's really well done. So,
Yeah, absolutely. And then we've got the whole EVP scene, which is when George T. Scott's character is listening back to the tape of the seance. and he's hearing the voice of the little boy. And I don't know how much that was portrayed in movies before this.
I can't think of, I mean, this doesn't mean anything, but I can't think of any examples of this before this. And I know,
I think this has really influenced a lot of ghost hunting lore today, because people will record a room and ask questions, and then when they play it back, have a subjective interpretation of what they think they heard, which is usually just ambient noise. But I think that that really has driven that theory.
I think so. I think so. If you look into the history of EVP, you'll probably see something about Thomas Edison wanting to build some kind of radio to the dead.
Which isn't
there's
true.
There's not much to that. But in 1959, there was a Swedish artist named Friedrich Jurgensen, might have been Jurgensen, who published a book called Voices from Space about his experiences recording the voices of dead people. And he called his work audioscopic research. And then a few years later, Konstantin Rodeve read Jurgensen's book. I guess
he read it. Rao Dive.
Voices. It looks like Rao Dive, but I went around online and heard it was pronounced Rodeve. But you know what? He was from Latvia. And my mother-in-law is from Latvia, so we could find out. I'll have to ask her about that.
Okay, cool.
He read Jurgensen's book in 1964 and eventually started doing his own experiments, thousands of them. And he called the recordings electronic voice phenomena. He's the guy that coined EVP.
And but he had published two phrases for it. He had electronic voice projection was one of them, and electronic voice phenomenon was the other one.
And they both fit under EVP. Isn't that great?
Yeah, very, very smooth. And I think phenomenon sounds creepier.
It does.
But was it him that also called it telecommunication or? Instrumental transcommunication.
But that could be that Sarah Estep. I think she might have come up with that term.
Yeah.
But they're bringing different terms.
He published his book, which in, I think, 68, and it became, the English translation was called Breakthrough and came out in 71. But the thing about EVPs is they're very subjective. In if you actually listen to the real examples, there are things where they're ambiguous and your mind can sort of resolve them into words, maybe. But in the movies, they're always really clear. What we hear in The Changeling and movies like The Sixth Sense and White Noise are extremely clear and understandable. And I would add, to be honest, if you were a ghost investigator and you hit something like this, you'd be, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. You know,
hey, dirt.
Like this is the lottery win right here.
It's absolutely not the reality with what people find.
No, unfortunately.
I've been in lots of amusing situations where I've seen ghost hunters argue over what was being said, and no, they said this, and no, the ghost said that, and it just proves how subjective it is. And then some of them will grade the quality of the recordings and say this is an A grade recording or a C grade. But I mean, there's just no way to make this scientific. It's just
very
not
gold dress, blue dress here. But you know, you know the thing about it is it's subjective, but it's still creepy. You know, it. I wish they were clear. That'd be fantastic. I wish there was that lack of ambiguity is really annoying.
In the film, it's very fun.
Yeah, if the ghost got something to say, speak up.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Although, well, I think that the trailers for White Noise were really super creepy, but the film was a real letdown. Sorry.
Yeah. Yep. But then we have this lady. What was that?
Who I was referring to earlier from the Historical Society.
Yeah, she's the head of the Historical Society.
Yeah, I do think that that's one of the best quotes in the film, where she refers to the house and says that it doesn't want people. And that's why they haven't had anyone rent the house until this composer comes in, and that even then the other woman who's been assisting him, that she'd pushed that through their lawyers for him to get into the house, because no one should be living in the house.
Right. Yeah, this is Claire. Claire basically gets him into the house real quick, and it seems like she's circumvented the process, which the process would have been, no, you're not allowed to stay there. It's haunted. Also, she seems to be like she isn't clear on what's going on, but she seems like she's working for the senator somehow.
Yeah, she was in communication with the senator, and it just seemed very odd.
Yeah, I'm very she's suspicious.
Some kind of link there. But so, do you want to talk any more next? About the film, or do you want to start talking about the folklore and the facts?
Yeah, let's get into the folklore a little bit. Let's talk about, okay, here's...
So again, it didn't actually happen in Seattle, the story.
Yeah, let's start. We have to move it closer to Denver. Yeah.
Yeah, Denver, Colorado. The house was on 1739 East 13th Avenue, and it was constructed in 1892. Built
beautiful
by...
Beautiful house.
Yeah, yeah. Henry Treat Rogers was the man who had it built and moved in. Now, Russell Hunter is the name of the composer. So the story goes that this Broadway composer was burnt out with the hustle and bustle of New York and all the problems. So he came to Denver to get away from it all and moved into this huge mansion by himself in 1969, in February of 1969. Now, supposedly, the rent was $200 a month. And even at that time, for a house that big, that was really good. But it's a big house, makes a lot of noises, creaks, and he's freaking out about everything. But he's trying to keep his cool, you know, just wants to concentrate on his music. So after a little while, he keeps hearing the sound of a ball bouncing down the stairs. Never sees the ball, just can hear it. He keeps hearing this loud, rhythmic, metallic thump that would happen. It started a little more infrequently, but then got more and more frequent in terms of once a morning, really, it would happen. He would often hear like voices coming from the fireplace. So he was really starting to get freaked out. Creepy. Now, one day he's rummaging around in this closet, and he finds that there's a hidden stairway. So he pulls the boards off the wall and everything, and he goes up the stairway. And up at the top of the stairs is a door that's boarded up and locked and everything. And he breaks everything down and gets in the room. And as soon as the door opens, a red rubber ball rolls out and bounces down the stairs.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say. Your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Pretty creepy. But he goes in and thank you, buddy. He goes in and he finds a journal in this trunk that's 100 years old. He finds a music box. There's a big cast iron tub in there. And he finds a really old child's wheelchair all covered in cobwebs.
Correct my memory. This is 69, thereabouts?
69, yes.
Okay, so that would make the journal 1869?
Yes.
Okay. Before the house was built.
Right. Yeah. So before the house was built. Yeah. Yeah. And you guys are totally ruining the folklore here. It
says here, constructed in 1892.
People that like to believe folklore don't always read everything. So can you just go along with me for a minute? So once he kind of discovers this room, the activity in the home really steps up. It ramps up, and pictures are falling off of walls, and drawers are opening and closing, and there's all kinds of stuff going on. So he decides he's going to do some research into this and find out what's going on. So he contacts some psychics. Now, these psychics they come over and they do a seance. And what they find out in the seance is that there was indeed a little boy that lived up in that room. And this was back when the house was first built. He lived up in that room. And when he turned 18, he was set to inherit different figures here. $30 million, $70 million, $300 million, $700 million. So it depends on who you ask. He was going to inherit a lot of money.
All the money.
Yeah, all the money in Denver. Now, thing is he would have to make it to 18 years old to get that money. And the problem was he was sickly and they didn't think he was going to survive. So the family boarded him up into that room and adopted a similar looking child to take his place, the changeling. Now, the guy's really freaked out because now he's got this really angry spirit in his house. What is he going to do? Well, the psychics tell him that the body is buried in South Denver off of South Dahlia Street. And if he can go down there and talk to the people who own the house where, you know, the boy is now buried underneath it, and let him dig, he'll find the body and he'll find a gold medallion that has the boy's name and his date of birth on it. And he can then take that as proof to the world, tell the child's story, and bring some peace to this disturbed spirit. So he does indeed go down to this house. He speaks with the family and explains why he needs to tear up a closet floor and dig underneath. And they say, please leave.
As you would.
As you would. So after a few weeks, they're getting all kinds of phenomenon in their house suddenly. Things are going crazy until to the point they call him back up and say, please come dig. So he does. He goes and he digs, tears up the floor, digs it, finds the bones and finds the gold medallion. So now he's got a good friend named William Gray, who's a screenplay writer. They get together. They write up the whole story. They sell it to a Toronto film company. And we have The Changeling starring George C. Scott. And now this poor spirit is at rest. That's basically the folklore behind the story.
The folklore was that the boy was just sort of barricaded into the room and just they locked it off and locked him away
They did lock him away, but he was, I mean, ultimately he was murdered. Because he was a drain on the family because, you know, they had to keep feeding him and, you know,
specify how, or he was just starved, or
he was drowned, and that's why there was that thumping. He was banging on the side of the tub as he was being drowned, so that sound would come back every, you know, early morning, in the wee hours of the morning. It would come back and disturb the resident of the house.
That's what always freaked me out when I like looked into this, because I thought, oh, based on a true story, so I guess there's a few elements that are supposed to be true in the movie. No. Like the movie is allegedly completely true. Every crazy thing is supposed to like really happen. And then, okay, maybe we can find some testable components. Cause that's what us skeptic movie ruiners like to do.
That is what we do. Let me show you where this house was situated really quickly. So you can kind of see now the house was torn down in the mid 70s.
It didn't even make it to the movie.
Soon after he had allegedly rented the place.
Right. So you can see on the map here, we got Denver. Mm-hmm. So as I kind of zoom in here, you see Cheeseman Park right here.
Mm-hmm. So it might be worth mentioning, I mean, you may have already said this if I missed, he was renting this house so he could do what exactly?
He wanted to be able to get away from the rat race and just kind of concentrate on his music and not be pressured by, you know, the business side of music. So,
okay.
In other words, he was unemployed.
is there evidence that he actually did rent the house?
There is no evidence. And it's unfortunate because of the fact that records weren't very well kept at the time. And you would think that there would be like phone records and stuff. There actually aren't. So it's not that he definitely wasn't there. There definitely aren't records to show whether he was or wasn't. But the reason he was in Colorado wasn't necessarily to get away from the rat race. It was because his parents owned a hotel in Boulder that he was going to help them run as they were getting up in years. And that was the real story. But the thing is supposedly while he was doing that, he wanted a place he could go to just work on his music. And that was this big.
That is a little strange, though, that he should be moving to Colorado to either live or work with his parents in Boulder, which is still quite some distance from Denver.
It really is. It's a nice drive, but it would be inconvenient in the winter. I would say that.
It would. Yeah. It absolutely would be.
Absolutely. Okay, so here on the edge of Cheeseman Park. Now, as you remember in the movie, it was Chessman Park near Seattle. Which I don't think exists. It might. I don't know.
No, I believe that was made up for the film.
Yeah. But Cheeseman Park is very real. And as we come down here, you see this East 13th Avenue sign right here. This high rise, surprisingly enough, was not there. But this is the parking lot where the Changeling House sat. Now, as wow. we kind of zoom in, you can see that some of the older houses are still around and hanging out here. But this one wiped out right there in the 70s.
And aren't there some claims now that there's still ghostly activity in the parking lot?
You know, I have heard of actually people in the apartment complex here still feeling like there are things going on there. But mm-hmm. the problem with that is that Cheeseman Park itself has so many legends and folklore around it that...
And
it would be hard to say if there was a ghost, where would it be from, the Changeling House or Cheeseman Park?
Does Russell Hunter make any connection or link between the Changeling House and Cheeseman Park?
He doesn't. And the reason he doesn't is the Changeling House was built 2 years after Cheeseman Park stopped being the city cemetery.
Okay.
So they had changed it into a park, and 2 years later, the Changeling House was built. And then by the time Russell Hunter had rented the house, oddly enough, he didn't have good Wi-Fi and a good internet connection to be able to actually look up what had happened in Cheeseman Park. So as far
he
as
just wasn't aware of the lore,
was not aware of what really happened in Cheeseman Park at all.
This, and, in a real sense, this is like this guy rents a house across the street from the Bates Motel and never mentions the Bates Motel in his story.
Right.
Cheeseman Park has such an amazing amount of creepy lore around it.
Mm-hmm, so,
yep.
You want to explain that a little bit, Matthew? Because I know that you've done tours in that area. But
yeah. Now you can see how big Cheeseman Park is. It's a pretty sizable park. And you see there's a Congress Park over here. And mm-hmm. right here is the Botanic Gardens. This entire area right here was a cemetery. And when I say was, it actually still is. Long ago in Denver, in most cities, back around that time, it was really important to have a beautiful cemetery. It was the kind of the city's crown jewel. So it was kind of, one of these things where Denver wanted this land. It was kind of on a nice hill. It was a really beautiful area. You could see all around it. None of these houses were here, obviously. And it's about 2 miles away from downtown Denver. So there was not much in between. And it was just this beautiful area. Now, it actually was a Native American burial ground before. And they always say these kinds of things. Well, you know, a lot of Native Americans didn't have burial grounds. So it's usually a load of crap when someone says, oh, it was an ancient Indian burial ground. Usually wasn't. In this case, this wasn't an Arapaho burial ground. And it was sacred. Now, when the federal government acquired it from the Arapaho, let me pop back out here for a second. What had happened was there was a stipulation that if they were going to do anything with this land, they could not disturb the Native American bodies that were buried there. And they were buried about 6 feet down. So anybody that got buried there in the cemetery could only be buried about 3 feet down. On top of the fact that the soil in this area was bentonite, which when it gets wet, it kind of moves around a lot. So you've got a bunch of skeletons now that are shallow and they're moving around every time it rains or we have a good snow melt. So it was really just a recipe for horror movie, you know, stuff. But is not in the Changeling at all. Doesn't even factor into it. Now, it's interesting because when things started going awry with this whole Cheeseman Park thing, bodies started surfacing again because of the soil and things like that. And it became a real concern about the health aspect of it. There was a lot of people that were like, this could spread disease. Tuberculosis was all the rage. All the kids were doing it. So they were really concerned about diseases coming up and things like that. So we have to move these people, and the park or the cemetery's fallen into disrepair anyway. Let's turn it into a park and get the bodies out. As they were moving the bodies out, there was a problem with the supply of coffins to put the bodies into, because when you're only 3 feet down and the ground is kind of, it'll dry out, get wet, dry out, get wet. If you're 6 feet down, it stays damp all the time. But 3 feet down, it doesn't necessarily do that. And it starts to get acidic, and it will start eating through things. So it was eating through these coffins. It was eating through the clothes and the flesh. So in a short amount of time, these bodies were becoming skeletons very quickly. Everything was just getting eaten away. So it was a pretty frightening thing for a lot of people. But the big problem is the coffins were being eaten away. So when they were pulling up these caskets and everything, they were falling apart. Mm-hmm. So they had to be put into new caskets, new coffins, to be moved to a different cemetery. But Undertaker McGovern was the guy who was in charge of it all, and he's doing his best, but he's running out of coffins.
Lois Bitter. Which was like...
Yeah, he was. Now, there's a lot of folklore about Undertaker McGovern and what an evil person he was. Most of it's not true. They really like to portray him as the worst guy in the world, but no, it's not true. He really worked hard to get all this done in the time they allotted him, but he's running out of coffins. So he gets a hold of him, and he's like, look, I'm running out of coffins here. And they're like, well, use children's coffins. Just break the bodies in half if you have to. So now he's having to break bodies in half. They're like, hey, we'll pay you per coffin. So if you're getting paid twice as much for each body, that's the way it has to be. So the city knew, the city government knew what was going on. He wasn't being sneaky by doing this. This was part of the deal. So again, he's not evil Undertaker McGovern. So he's going along doing all this. And as he's doing this, you got people that are grave robbing like crazy, because people are in the upper class are getting buried with a lot of expensive jewelry and things like that. Some people just need shoes. So there's a lot of grave robbing going on. And the Chinese, they had their own area in there, and they had a different sort of ritual that they would only consider the bones to be sacred. And they have a whole thing called a second burial and everything. We won't go into it right now.
But did the government like pass any rules about stop doing that? Like desist with the deceased?
Nope. Okay. So you've got all these Chinese bodies that they're being scraped of everything except for the bones. So they're burying the bones, and then they leave this big pile of not bones.
Nice.
So you got all these things going on. This is so nice to talk about. So you've got all these things going on. And finally, the newspapers get a hold of it. And the headline was "The Work of Ghouls." And this is actually the headline here. And of course, they're really making it sound horrible. So,
well, it kind of is.
it kind of is. There was a lot of things going on, but we won't say that it was any one person's fault.
Yeah.
But at this point, you know, there was like 1,500 bodies, I think, you know, 15,000 bodies, I think, in the whole area, because it's a huge cemetery. And they were not done getting everybody out when this headline came out. And the city government said, boom, we're done. Everybody out of the pool, you know. We're sealing it up right where it is. So there's still 2,000 to 5,000 bodies still there today. And a lot of people question me about that. Oh, are you sure the bodies are still there? Actually, I am. And the reason I am is that there I am cleaning off a humerus from one of the skeletons that were pulled up. Did some work with the human identification lab at Metro State University. And we reconstructed five skeletons that we pulled up. And it was a very interesting day getting to really hang out with the dead people at Cheeseman Park. It was a stunning experience, to say the very least.
Yeah, with this history, it's just astonishing that it wasn't connected to the changeling story at all. Just these two phenomena right next to each other.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, if you've got a kid like haunting you, you don't need to go across the street to find the rest of the ghosts.
Yeah.
Right. So. Yeah. So they totally missed all of the amazing things that have gone on at the Cheeseman Park. So we've got problems here, though, when we talk about this folklore. One, like I said, there's no record of Russell Hunter living at the house. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean necessarily that he wasn't there, but that's a problem. The inheritance size, whether it's 30 million or 700 million, really no one in Denver had that kind of money at that time. And, you know, it would have been well known. You know, at this point, it would have been really well known.
Well, what about the kid? Was there any kind of record of a child ever being in the home of Henry Treat Rogers?
Death certificate.
Yep. Well, Henry Treat
Rogers. Any other family?
Henry Treat Rogers had no children. No children at all. He had a niece and a nephew that stayed with him for a while. They had no sicknesses. They didn't live with them, you know, their whole lives, just stayed there a little while. And they weren't seemingly replaced by any body snatchers of any kind. So that doesn't fit. And that kind of blows a hole in the whole thing right there.
It does. And is there any other kind of evidence, like the journal, did that ever surface?
The journal never surfaced. And the thing is, you know, you guys brought it up before. You know, when the house was built, doesn't match up with a 100-year journal that would have been there
80 years. Yeah,
40 years before. This guy looking up.
Oh, yes, yeah.
So it's just, you know, it just doesn't seem like it. But, you know, on the other side, when they tore this place down in the 70s, it was interesting because they say that as, you know, this bulldozer is knocking down one of the walls, that the wall exploded and killed the bulldozer driver.
Yeah.
Other reports say the entire house exploded. Other reports say that the house imploded, like at the end of Poltergeist.
You should mention, by the way, Cheeseman Park and the Poltergeist.
Cheeseman Park, actually, yeah, was one of the places that inspired the movie Poltergeist. Yeah. Which, you know, we may be talking about in another episode of Debased on a True Story.
It can happen.
So it's, you know, when you go back and look, there's no records.
There isn't, right, exactly. There's all kinds of interesting records around construction and destruction stuff happening. So when a house falls onto a bulldozer operator, that makes the newspapers. It really does. But it didn't this time. There's nothing like that. There's nothing like that at all.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's a bummer, you know. I mean, when we go back, though, we haven't been able to find any blueprints or plans for the house. So we don't know. Maybe there was a hidden staircase in there. You know, Maybe this room did exist. Maybe Russell Hunter actually did stay in the house and he found these things up in that attic. We don't know for sure. The facts sort of point away from that being true, but we don't know for certain that he wasn't there because records were poorly kept. So we don't know if he stayed there or not. So
it's just so interesting that neighbors never came forward and said anything. I mean, it seems like anecdotally, if you go and read the history boards and chat rooms and things like that, forums where people have spoken about the movie, it seems like quite a few people who knew Russell Hunter said that he was known for embellishing his story and known for embellishing this particular story. But yeah, you'd think that neighbors or someone would have come forward and said something over the years, and it's just been silent.
Exactly. Yeah.
So briefly, except that we can't prove he stayed there, and we can't prove that there was ever a child because there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that. And we can't prove that
there was an inheritance.
There was an inheritance. Or a murder, or a body found to placate a ghost.
And why would that ghost be any more angry than all the ghosts that supposedly were violated right across the street?
We got no will. We've got...
Oh, but apparently Rogers did own land in South Denver.
Yeah, so there's that. I mean, we should probably do a chart about things that claimed and things that hold up and what doesn't. Yeah. But it seems like basically nothing holds up. Except that there was another piece of property owned by him.
But do not let that keep you from watching this movie.
No, no, it's a fantastic movie. It's fun. It's creepy. It's scary. It's awesome.
Whatever he was smoking to come up with this stuff, I'm happy he did.
No, it's good stuff. Yeah. It's a really good movie.
Isn't there one more theory that he based, that Russell Hunter based the story on that of a senator, a Colorado senator?
Oh, yeah. Was it
who
Fitz?
Was around? I think so.
Yeah. And the timing didn't seem right on that.
Yeah, that one didn't match up either. I mean, it might have been a source of some inspiration. And that, you know, and we got to kind of split hairs there a little bit, too. You know, we talk about based on a true story. What do they really mean when they say that? Are they talking, you know, that some little fact in all of this inspired me to write this fiction? Or, you know, what are they actually saying based on a true story?
Yeah, I think the claim is that he based the story on the Phipps family and they silenced him. So we had to change all of the details.
Well, he did a terrible job of being silent.
he did. But I mean, like, he was, I'm just going to say ballsy in his approach. I mean, like, he just made a lot of straight up, oh, this happened and this happened and this happened. And it didn't seem like much of the media really pushed back on that. You do eventually get some really cool, we'll put some links to that in the show notes. You get some interesting sort of debunkings from some local Denver groups, but that's much later. That's like in the 90s, I think. So
yeah,
it gets a good solid decade of just running with it. So
yeah, it really does. Really does. And I'm kind of glad because it was a lot of fun. And you know, we can sit here and tear it apart, but you know.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, like, the point of this series is not necessarily to tear things apart, but it is. There's this concept that happens in the movie industry and marketing that if we say it's based on a true story, it gets more play with audiences because it's more scary because they can imagine it really happened. Mm-hmm. This one seemed a little like even for that kind of thing, it seems a little over the top with what they're claiming. And as we go through some of these movies in this series, some of them are much more based on things that might have happened, and some of them are wildly divergent from the source material, but maybe the source material is true. So we're going to get an interesting spectrum of stuff to work with on this. This could be a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah, I think.
And,
so
do you have any questions from the audience that I think we've been following the chat room
today? It was something about socks.
I do want to state, I am in my socks, yes. But I do want to say too that there was no death in Russell Hunter's family with a wife and daughter or anything like that. That didn't happen.
So, no, yeah. There's been a lot of fun chat going on, but I'm not seeing a lot of stories or
questions.
I'm not seeing a lot of questions directed at us, but they are having a fun time watching and hanging out, which I love that. That's great.
So, yeah.
All right.
So yeah, it's just a shame that there were never any artifacts like the music box and the journal. I think that would have been really fascinating and interesting. He didn't fabricate anything like that, like create something himself to bolster and support his story.
Absolutely, you know, and it's fun because, you know, with the Cheeseman Park, you know, bodies that I had had the opportunity to work with, there were lots of artifacts other than the bodies. There was lots of casket hardware. There were combs and buttons and different things that survived, you know, made out of bone or ivory and things like that. So there were artifacts there, but nothing from the, you know, changeling story. So,
which story do you think is more famous than the changeling story or the Cheeseman Park stories?
At this point, because of the internet, I think the Cheeseman story has really gained a lot because of the interest in paranormal reality TV. The story is so in depth, and they've really had a good opportunity to malign a lot of people and create, you know, villains and heroes and everything throughout it. That it really gained a lot of steam, and the changeling kind of got forgotten along the way. And, you know, I'll often bring up the changeling and people will be like, never heard of it. You know, not even the Angelina Jolie one.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, maybe justified. I don't know. I haven't seen it.
But it holds up well. I mean, I put it up in like my top five ghost movies. I mean,
me too.
Wow. Yeah,
so It's
saying something good, for you, Blake.
It is. I've seen a lot, but it's a goodie. It's a real good. And partly because a lot of what it does is it doesn't necessarily show you. It hints at things. And so you get to use your imagination. And I don't know about you, but my imagination is really vivid. No, Russell Hunter passed away in August 1996. So he's no longer a composer. Now he's a decomposer.
Did he leave behind any family, I wonder, and anyone who
kept
up his stories?
I never saw in any of the newspaper articles, I never saw anything about him being like having a family. So maybe he does. I'm not sure. But
there are a few other haunted houses or supposedly haunted houses in that area too, aren't there? I mean, aside from the Changeling House and from Cheeseman Park, there are a number of other places which are
The Croke Patterson Mansion is another very famous one. There are a few others in the area, but Croke Patterson Mansion is probably one of the big ones. And that one's got a great, great story, a lot of stories behind it. It's like everyone that lived there throughout the history, or the time when it was a law office, so the time it was a dance nightclub, all these crazy different things. It was a restaurant for a while, and every sort of iteration of this place, it has creepy stories to go with it. And it's a fun one, and I've spent many nights in that place doing investigations, and there's no way you can't be creeped out by the place. It's remarkable. So we'll have to talk about it.
Strange place. And then the Botanical Gardens as well. They're reputedly haunted too.
Botanic Gardens is, it's part of the same.
Botanic.
Yeah. I think it kind of goes by both names, Botanic. It's part of that same cemetery. And it was just a few years ago, they unveiled quite a few bodies as they were building the new parking lot there.
Great. Hey, yeah. So, when they were actually originally converting it from a cemetery to a park and they were dealing with all those bodies, was that considered part of the big Denver ghoul rush?
Just one pun right at the end.
All your drinking right there.
Yeah. All right. Are we ready for our exciting conclusion?
Well, I want to thank you guys for letting me be a part of this.
Thanks for coming on the show. You really know a lot about these stories, and it was really cool to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate it. And I do want everyone to know that I really want to push the whole idea of going and becoming a patron for their Patreon page. And I am not involved in that in any sense.
No, completely unbiased. And
I actually don't get any of that whatsoever. That's something that supports the Monster Talk itself. And I'm a big believer in Monster Talk myself. So
yeah, we should also thank everyone for watching this or listening, depending on where you're coming across this. And yes, certainly if you're watching through YouTube, if you can subscribe to our channel,
that'd be great.
Thumbs up for this video, and share it.
YouTube algorithm.
We've got close to 20 of these we're looking at doing, so this should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Thanks, lots of fodder.
All right.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us. Good night. Good morning.
So much. Good night, and I look forward to the next time.
Monster Dog.
You've been listening to a podcast version of Monster Talk Live, a special feature that we recorded during 2020. Links to the video version of these episodes are in the show notes. Please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, and we'll work to continue to provide good content there, including more streaming events in the future. Monster Talk is a listener-supported program, and your subscription at patreon.com/monstertalk sustains us during these difficult times. Thank you for your support and for your positive reviews. I'm Blake Smith. And along with my co-host Karen Stolzno, we ask you to join us in being the voice of reason and science in a world that's perilous with nonsense, superstition, and dangerous misinformation. Shine your lights, everyone. Even a flickering candle can be seen for miles in the darkness. And together, we are stronger. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back.
Protect your dream home with American Family Insurance. And you can weather any storm. You'll also save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote. Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.